Convene the finance committee. We don't have a quorum yet, so we won't take any action on any of the bills until we do have a quorum, but we'll start with the authors presenting the bills and then lay them over until a quorum. It's kind of like your committee revisited. I hope I have the same situation. I think I was in mid-sentence when you said quorum present when we were before your division with one of my bills the other day. But Representative Pawlowski, if you could explain House File 2904, and then we won't take action until more members arrive. So Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House File 2904 comes to us as a result of what happened this fall with the special session. After the special session, I had a debriefing in my office on the bill that we dealt with during the special session because there were some problems with that bill. Many of you know that we were literally building it on the fly. And after the special session was over and we had a couple of weeks to decompress, Kathy Novak in particular has been outstanding. No one could tell me where the bill came from. There was no single source as to where the bill that was passed that was addressing over $100 million actually came from. So subsequently, then in October, November, December, and January, there were a series of meetings in my office with all of the agencies involved and with House staff to take a look at creating a framework for disaster, using as the premise a presidential declaration. So what you see before you in House File 2904 has gone through at least seven or eight drafts. The last draft was done in the governor's office in January, where we again went through everything that you see before you, in the hope that when we have another disaster in Minnesota, that the people of Minnesota, the local units of government, and the state legislature and the governor's office will at least have a statutory framework to work within so that if we appropriate money, that we know where that money is going to go, and we know that we have language that has been worked on by all of the various agencies. Members, I can walk you through this rather quickly. On page one, you see a list of definitions, and perhaps the most salient one is the definition dealing with a presidential declaration. We took that as a premise for a number of reasons. One, it is the highest type of disaster. It also then facilitates federal aid, and you'll see references in the bill to FEMA and other federal agencies. The questions have come up, what happens if there's a disaster that's less than that? Well, you would still have the statutory framework. You could then take parts of that statutory framework, for instance, if there was a tornado in St. Peter or a flood in a particular area and it didn't warrant a presidential declaration, there would still be framework involved. If you go to page two, again, you begin to see the same type of flexibility that we had in the disaster bill during special session, but you also see here the references to FEMA that would be required if there was a presidential declaration. And then at the bottom of page two in subdivision five, the transfers. One of the unique contributions of Ms. Novak was to put this in alphabetical order, so that we would have the agencies listed in a way where you'd be able to find them. You may not think that's terribly novel, but I don't think it came until the fifth draft. So you start with the Department of Ag, you go through Education, Bowser, Employee and Economic Development, and on page four. On page four, down in subdivision two, there were some questions about what happens when we have rather large utilities involved, like Tri-County Electric or Ace Communications. That's resolved in this language. On page 5, at the very top, we have specific references to the Department of Labor. Again, if it's a federal disaster, there have to be references to that. If we go to page 6, again, there's a flexibility language that we used before with certain waivers. Down at the section 10 in page 6, subdivision 2, there was again a question about what happens if we have different types of agencies that are involved. You see the references to residential health care, child care, social services. This clarifies what we can do in a disaster with those types of agencies. On page 7, you see the flood mitigation grants on, in section 12. On page 8, once again, references to FEMA. And then on page 9, again, the flexibility with a certain waiver authorization. Members, there is no money in this bill. On Friday, I met with Representative Solberg just to confirm that there is no appropriation in the bill. The only way that this bill could authorize an appropriation would be if the legislature met and appropriated money depending on the particular disaster. So, members, the motion would be that House File 2904 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
And we'll have to hold on that motion, Representative Flowski, for a few moments, yet we're close but not quite at a quorum. But we will take questions. Representative Flowski, do you have your seating charts in your classrooms in alphabetical order?
Mr. Chair, it depends on the level. In the advanced classes, I usually let them sit wherever they wish. In the regular classes, I usually have a specific seating chart for a specific purpose.
I operated the same way.
Mr. Chair.
That's just a little aside as we're waiting for a quorum.
Mr. Chair.
Do we have any questions? Representative Plosky, though, seriously, if you'll maybe reference the role of the division chairs, because this does cut across so many divisions, what our process was.
Mr. Chair, I believe there are two memos that division chairs got. There was one from my committee, and then there was a subsequent memo from your committee to take a look at it because of the number of agencies that are involved here.
We have Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Plosky. I think it's a great idea. I was wondering if you have had any feedback from the current efforts that are going on in southeast Minnesota in regards to the flood issue. I know that we had poured a bunch of money into businesses down there, and we had put some in towards housing, and now we're finding that we have a surplus on the business side, and we've got people that are scraping for dollars to stay in their homes down there that they've been repairing, and I was wondering if you could address that at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, if you remember in the original bill, if one account had been drained, money could be shifted from other accounts in the legislation that was passed. This bill also makes that type of a reference of the shifting that could occur, but you'd have to have money in the accounts for that to happen. Are you talking about specific reference to this bill, or are you talking about what happened?
Thank you. And Representative Plowski, to what had happened. The bill that we passed this summer and why that isn't working.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, the bill before you is in part an answer to that. I think if we had had a plan in place before we'd gone in to southeastern Minnesota, the results would have been different. The agencies would have known, first of all, what responsibilities they would have had. The local units of government in particular would have known. The legislature would have known, and the governor would have known. I think it may have been easier to have called a special session if we would have said, here's the framework, now let's assess what the totality of the need is, and let's move forward. We didn't have that. I was rather amazed that for a state that's 150 years old, we had no place in statute to deal with a disaster. We've always done it on the fly.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Peterson.
And I understand what you're saying, Representative Plowski, but you're still not asking my question. The situation that we have right now, where they have a surplus in the administrative account for businesses and the want that we have on the housing side, has that lent any guidance to this, and what is dysfunctional in that this bill fixes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, this bill does not attempt to address what's currently going on in southeastern Minnesota. This attempt is to be a much broader policy statement. I believe Representative Drazkowski, and I'm a co-author of that bill, has legislation that attempts to address that.
Okay, Representative Rukavina? Okay. Any other discussion on the bill, and then we'll temporarily lay it over if there are no questions at this point. Okay, thank you, Representative Plosky. We'll take your motion as soon as we have a quorum. The next bill is House File 3346 by Representative Dabney. And Representative Dabney will operate the same way she can present the bill. We'll take questions and then wait to act until we have a quorum.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to be have this bill heard today. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency provides foreclosure prevention assistance through nonprofits across the state. Currently, we have a cap in statute of assistance to homeowners of $5,500 to assist them with payments, including utilities, to keep them in their home while they stabilize their own financial situation and hopefully avoid foreclosure. So foreclosure prevention counselors work with identifying recipients in the best position to remain in their homes as a priority in administering these funds. The funds are generally set up as a zero-interest loan, repayable when the property no longer is the primary residence of the recipient. Unfortunately, that $5,500 cap no longer reflects current home costs, and this bill simply changes that cap from a fixed dollar amount to 110% of the greater of the state or metropolitan statistical area median monthly owner cost multiplied by 6, which works out roughly today between $10,000 and $11,000.
Representative Dabney, can I interrupt you real quickly? We now have a quorum present. So, Representative Pawlowski, being that you just finished, why don't we take your motion at this point, Representative Pawlowski?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I will move that House File 2904 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
That motion is before us, and if you're one of our recent arrivals, Representative Pawlowski presented the bill. We took questions, and unless there's a pressing question, we'll act on it. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Dabney, we need a motion on the... This one went to division, unlike the Pawlowski one.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 3346.
The division report.
Yes.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Sturdich, if you'd move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 3346. Okay, you recommend it to pass.
That motion is before us, and Representative Dabney, if you want to finish your presentation.
Mr. Chair, your timing was perfect. I think my presentation was completed.
Oh, I didn't interrupt you then.
Nope, not at all.
Okay. Any questions of Representative Dabney then on House File 3346? Representative Rucavina.
Representative Dabney, is there a cost to the state, or is it just that these folks are already getting up to that new amount, and so there's no fiscal cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavina, there is no fiscal cost. Last year, the legislature appropriated $1.73 million for foreclosure prevention. After that, an additional $500,000 was moved from a real estate fund into related work. Also, Marquette Bank has recently contributed, I believe it's either $400,000 or $500,000 is the hand signal from the MHFA lobbyist. And in addition, while no contract has been signed, the state is expecting $4 million from the federal government. It's part of the recent fiscal stimulus package that passed there for foreclosure assistance as well.
Do we have Representative Colt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dabney, okay, I understand now that was my question as well, mm-hmm. The question from Representative Rucavina, but I guess the concern I would have is do we believe that there's enough money in the account today to manage or deal with essentially the doubling of the amount that of assistance that's going to be available to individuals? I mean, this is it may be needed, it may be the right thing, but it's a big bump in the amount of assistance that we're providing to individuals. And I'm just curious if we're going to be back here, looking for an additional appropriation to fill that account, either, you know, get this session, or if God forbid, we have to come back in special session, or next year as we set the 10 and 11 budget, are we setting ourselves up for a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, two answers. One, I think I just walked through with the committee that there's a significant increase in funding coming into this program. But secondly, Tanya Orr from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is joining me at the table. Mr. Chair, she could speak to the specifics more knowledgeably than I, if you would.
Ms. Orr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. What is happening now is that people aren't getting served because the $5,500 isn't enough. And so we actually are underutilizing that money. And so we don't believe that, while we manage within the money that's available, and the counselors understand that they only have so much money to make, but they're turning away people who could be saved from their homes if the cap were a little higher. And so with between the raising of the cap and the money that we receive from Marquette Bank, we think that we'll be able to serve at least as many people as we have in the past.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Orr, is that correct? Ms. Orr, the commitment from Marquette Bank, is that a one-time payment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, yes, it is. However, they have made a commitment to raise some money from other lenders as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gavney, I support the concept of what you're doing here. I guess the concern I have is, you know, we have Marquette Bank being generous, and we have other people potentially stepping up to the plate. But if we're increasing the amount now, we're potentially setting up a budget problem for the state when and if those additional grants don't happen in the future. That would be the only concern I would have, Representative Dabney. I mean, I appreciate the generosity of Marquette Bank and others, but we're doubling the amount available, and we could be, if for whatever reason that generosity stops because they got their own financial problems or whatever it might be, I'd be concerned about the fact that we're obligating the state potentially to make these kind of payments in the future.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, this is not an open appropriation. It's a fixed amount of money. The MHFA has successfully solicited, in this case, additional funds from both private sector and the federal government. But the program has the money that this legislature appropriates for the program and no more. So while unfortunately the demand may be there, the demand is met within the limits of the appropriation that we've provided.
Okay, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dabney, I know we had this in Housing Public Health Finance, but my question still remains the same. You know, when we put in these projects or these programs, we typically like to believe that government is doing its thing and that this program is running effectively. This summer, shortly after session was out, my niece ran into an issue where he had gotten laid off the job for 3 months. They were behind on their rent, and the bank was coming to foreclose on him, wouldn't negotiate. I said, hey, I know this great program that we've just enacted in the legislature. She got a hold of the particular lending institution or the process that was supposed to go forth here, and the person that was representing it basically said they had run out of money. And this was early on in the summer, or potentially late summer. I guess my question goes to the issue here. If we're removing the caps, but we already don't have enough money in the system, why would we remove the caps and serve fewer people?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I think with your niece, there may have been an issue of she came in at the end of the biennium, unfortunately, which I know is no help for her, but the money can run out towards the end of the biennium. It is a fixed amount of money. It helps us try and manage it. But, you know, in some ways it doesn't help to say no to somebody who's going to lose their house because we want to have money 6 months from now. You know, with a fixed appropriation, we're not going to be able to help everyone. We have raised the cap in the past, and it has meant that there are people who are able to stay in their home if they could just catch up. We're able to help them. We're getting to the point where the $5,500 means you can only be maybe 2 or 3 months behind, and then you reach the cap. So I think it's a question of trying to make this program as effective as possible. We do have limited funds, and we know that this will potentially mean that fewer people are served. But I can tell you that counselors right now are saying we're passing on people that we should be able to help because the cap is too low. And they're also operating from the sense of we don't have enough money, and so they're just not helping as many people as they could. So we think that this will make a substantial improvement in the program, and you know, what we're looking for is keeping people in their homes.
The Representative Aguinius.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate what you both are doing. I think in this time, nothing could be more important, so good for you for working on this. One sense we're not getting is how many people will actually be served by the appropriations we had plus the infusions from other folks. Do you have a general number, an estimate of how many might be served with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Genius, if everyone received roughly $10,000, and we have between the state appropriations and the appropriation and the gift from Marquette, we have about $1 million available for financial assistance. So we would be able to serve 1,000 households in the biennial.
Well, I was thinking with also the infusion from other folks, it's going to be more than that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Genius, the additional money is for counseling as opposed to financial assistance, and that will, we actually were able to double the number of counselors in December. The $4 million that we expect to get, that we're working on a contract with the federal government, will quadruple the number of counselors that we have. It unfortunately is a 1-year appropriation, and we're trying to figure out how to make that work.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Chair Mazur. I assume that there's a means test on this, but maybe I'm wrong. And can you give me an example then of what kind of assistance they get for this amount of money? Or
Mr. Chair, Rukavina, it's not means tested. Anyone who is at risk of losing their home can seek help from a foreclosure preventive counselor. And the counselor will provide maybe one, just counseling. In many cases, it may be that this house is not affordable to you, regardless of whether we provide you with financial assistance or not. In the long run, it's not going to be affordable, and you need to think about selling. Or it will be working with the lenders to try and work out some sort of deferment of payments or reduction in payments to make the home affordable. And then if with some financial assistance the household can continue to maintain the home, then this financial assistance would be available, the loan of now with the cap raised up to $10,000, would be available as long as that resolves the crisis. So if going forward the household can demonstrate that they can stay in the home without additional help, then they get their financial assistance. It is repaid. We receive about $200,000 a year in repayments. So even though we don't have a income cap or means testing to get the assistance, we do get money back when the home is no longer their principal place of residence.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm Rukavina. So I've got a mortgage payment of $2,000 a month, and I can't make it, and I negotiate something with the bank, the lower one, and then maybe, as an example, you'd kick in $200 or $300 or $500 a month to help with the payment. Is that, or am I off track?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, we would pay the arrears, but we won't pay going forward. So the financial assistance is to just catch you up. It's not going forward.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Erhard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this a revolving fund? Is it, once it's paid out, is it assistance that has no return to it, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erhard, as I mentioned, it is a loan. It's not a grant to the household. We expect repayment when it's no longer their home, and we do receive repayments of about $200,000 a year. So it does revolve.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when you're no longer a resident in the home, what does that mean? I mean,
it means generally that they've sold their home. Or in some cases, it may mean that they've moved into a nursing home. But generally, it means they sold their home.
Well, Mr. Chairman, aren't there younger people that are also having mortgage foreclosures that might live there for the next 20 years or something, and be in their home, do you expect to return when they get back on their feet or something? Is there some kind of arrangement?
Ms. Orr?
Representative Earhart, we do expect that when they decide to move out of that home and sell it, then we have a lien on the house, and we expect repayment at that point. But if they chose to stay in their house for 20 years, we don't expect repayment until they're no longer in that house.
Thank you.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Orr, what happens if you provide assistance and it doesn't work to get the person out of the trouble they're in and a foreclosure happens? You said you have a lien, but is that superior to the mortgage note, I wouldn't think.
Ms. Orr.
Representative Cole, no, it's not. So we may have lost the money. We hope that the counselors have, in most cases, will have figured out before they make a decision about granting a loan that this is going to be something that's affordable to the family going forward.
Mr. Chairman, one final question. Ms. Ward, do you have any kind of statistics you can share with the committee as to how many times the agency has provided this assistance, and we nonetheless end up with a foreclosure, so the state loses the ability to recoup the money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I don't, off the top of my head, I can go back to the office and see if we have anything like that, but I've not seen anything.
Ms. Orr, if Representative you do have it, could provide it to me by email, or that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Sertich renews his motion that the House, or Senate, I guess we're dealing with a Senate file here, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or no, House file. 3346 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We now have the minutes. Representative Kahn, you're about to make three motions. So you want to include the minutes, sir? Representative
sure.
Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move approval of the minutes, March 4th.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. By way of announcement, we're going to go through as many of these bills and maybe all of them. We're going to have the commissioner joining us at 10 o'clock this morning, but we have an arrangement that if he finishes in the Senate earlier than that and gets over here before 10, then we'll just lay any remaining bills over to give the commissioner as much time as possible as he goes over the governor's recommendations for balancing the budget. Representative Kahn, would you care to move the
yes,
division report?
Yes, I move the division report to Senate File 1436.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? All those in favor then signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Okay, and Representative Kahn, Representative Hillstrom is the chief author, but wasn't able to be with us this morning, and Representative Kahn has agreed to present the bill. So, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and members, we do have people from the state auditor's office there if questions beyond my ability to answer are asked. Senate File 1436 is a technical bill brought forward by the state auditor, and the bill defines political subdivision and special district for purposes of the laws governing the state auditor. We then have conforming changes based on these definitions and special, and also there are some new requirements to special districts. And the bill defines political subdivision to mean a county, home rule, charter, statutory city, town, school district, metropolitan or regional agency, public corporation, public subdivision, or special district. And what's specifically excluded from the definition are agencies that are audited by the legislative auditor, which includes the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission, and Metropolitan Mosquito Control Commission. And there are new requirements for the special district, including that they have to file governance documents with the auditor and with annual special districts with annual revenues of more than the threshold amount. in a certain cities, and it was $150,000 in 2004, but that gets adjusted for inflation, has to provide for an annual audit by the state auditor or a public accountant. And special districts with less revenue have to have an audit at least once every 5 years and must prepare a financial statement in years in which the district is not audited. And it requires the financial statements and audits to be presented to the special district's governing board and filed with the state auditor within 180 days after the end of the district's fiscal year. I don't think there's any opposition to the bill. And as I said, I have the experts here to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions on the bill, Senate File 1436? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, are you redefining in this bill political subdivision just in this context the way it's used, because it's sprinkled throughout statutes in, I don't know, hundreds of places, it seems like. I was thinking of some that political subdivisions get breaks for licensing in their vehicles and things like this. Is it just in the area you're talking about here, or is it all over statute that every time you see political subdivision, it's going to be redefined as to this?
I think that that's essentially equivalent. If you note the change is that political, where we said local units of government, we're now saying political subdivisions. So, again, do I need anything? It's just this chapter that's redefining it, but I don't think it has any effect on the other one.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all in favor of the motion that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Okay. The next bill is House File 3167, and it's my understanding Representative Walker will be presenting the bill. Representative Huntley, would you care to move the division report?
Mr. Chair, I would move the division report.
On House File 3167. Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Huntley moves that House File 3167 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is for Representative Johnson, Mills on Wheels. This is a technical fix amendment that is meant to clarify legislation that we passed last year to help restore some of the state's senior nutrition funding for Meals and Wheels and senior congregant dining. As members may recall, 15% of the state's senior nutrition funds were cut in 2003. Last year, we were able to restore about 5% of them. However, it was a misclarification as it relates to how the board was supposed to allocate those dollars. The Board of Aging, the AAAs, and the advocacy community, and those impacted by this note would like this technical fix to be passed to the General Register.
Okay, any discussion on the motion? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, all this does, there was some counties were interpreting the law change that we passed last year as saying that they could only give the money to new groups that were doing Meals on Wheels and not continue or increase the funding to the groups that were already doing it. So this just clarifies that the group that were already doing it are also eligible for this money.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, I should repeat what the motion was, I guess, that House File 3167 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler. Yeah, okay. Representative Winkler is next with House File 3143. Yes, we'll take the division report first. This was in your division, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Any discussion on the division report? Seeing none, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Rukavina moves that House File 3143 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Rukavina?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, then I'd offer the A3 amendment because then this becomes purely a tax bill instead of also an appropriation from deed to pay for it. So.
Okay. The
otherwise, Mr. Chair, I was going to have it sent back from taxes to my committee, but no, it doesn't have to be.
With this, if this amendment goes on,
right?
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor, then signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, members, the House File 3143. Is an attempt to deal with one specific area of the economy that is crucial. As we consider this session, the budget, it's also important to keep in mind what's been happening with Minnesota's economy relative to the rest of the country, which is that we are slipping behind in a number of areas, including job growth, our personal income ranking, and we are also slipping behind the rest of the country in the percentage of the nation's angel and venture capital investment that we are seeing in this state. This bill creates a tax credit for individuals or companies who, C-Corps, who invest in early stage technology companies. It gives them a 25% tax credit up to $25,000. So an individual could invest in one of these companies. They could make a $100,000 investment and claim a $25,000 credit against their personal income tax burden. And the key thing, I think, is that the state economist has really identified the R&D sector of the economy, the early stage technology sector of the economy, as one of the reasons that Minnesota is slowing down. And it keeps us from being the kind of nimble place that can change with changing economic times. We do very well with technology deals of $5 million and above, especially in the medical technology sector. We really have a problem with early stage companies below that. And so this is what this bill tries to address.
Okay. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor that House File 3143 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. House File 2805, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the division report on House File 2805.
Representative Rukavina, this one didn't happen to go to division. I think the next one did, but
I thought this one did. I thought we heard this.
So if you'll hold that motion, but instead, Representative Mahoney, if you want to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2805 be recommended pass referred to Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and would you explain the bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this last year we eliminated the provision. We imposed licensing on plumbers in cities under 5,000. It was time we brought everybody into the 21st century. We did have some problems with people not catching the date, the end date, the January date of the register. There's about 200 people in small towns, some in the southeast with the floods. We are extending that date to October 1st, 2008. And the October 1st date is to get this finished prior to all the other licensings which expire on December 31st, such as a high-pressure steam license like I carry or some all the other plumber's license that end on have to be renewed by the first of the year. The other provision in here also allows the commissioner to waive penalties for an applicant who failed to post the bond prior to this in the event that it creates a hardship. We have bent over backwards trying to figure out a way to get these people restricted plumbing licenses, master and journeyman license. We are, again, trying to accommodate people that were caught unaware.
Okay, any discussion on the Motion.
Chairman.
Senator Earhart.
Representative Mahoney, what does restricted mean? It's been used in several places here.
Well, that would mean, Mr. Chair and Representative, that would mean that they could operate or perform work in cities under 5,000.
Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, then Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 2805 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Mahoney, you might just as well stay there, or you're getting your notes, so okay. This is House File 2972, dealing with Minnesota technology, and Representative Rukavina, this is the one you must have been thinking of.
Sir, I know I saw this one. I thought I saw the last one, too, but I guess that would have happened on the last one. It was just a date change, so I passed it on to you.
Yeah.
Even though it cost a little bit of money, I think.
All right.
Anyway.
There was a fiscal note on that last one, but it's out of the special fund. That's why it went to Ways and Means. So, Representative Rukavina?
Yeah, I'll move 2972, committee report.
Okay, the division report is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Mahoney?
Chair, I'd like to move this first committee engrossment is to be recommended to pass to the General Register.
For House File 2972. Okay, and if you would explain the bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House File 2972 is a cleanup bill. It cleans up statutory language pertaining to Minnesota Technology, Inc. There are a couple of other organizations out there with very similar names. This changes the name to Enterprise Minnesota, Inc. This is a program from 1991 that was in place to help grow technology businesses, help do startup monies and other things. It has changed, and it had, at that time it was in relationship to the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. It does not have much of a connection with them any longer, and we are legislatively separating the two. Now, Minnesota Enterprise Inc. will use its ability to help small companies in the rural area and the urban area to update its technology so that they can better compete worldwide. The other part to this bill that the only part that really created any controversy in the other committee that it was heard was removed the president's salary limit of 95%. And seeing how it does not get any appropriation for salaries from the state, they have asked that be removed so that they can have their ability to hire as they need to.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, could you explain what you're doing and why on page 3, lines 311 and 312 concerning health insurance benefits?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I believe I will ask the current president of this organization to come down and explain that.
Welcome, and if you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is Robert Hill. I'm the president of Minnesota Technology. And if I could ask for the question to be repeated.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, the witness on page 311 and 312 is troubling me just because I don't understand it. It was that you could extend the health care insurance benefits to all employees, but you're striking that. I was just wondering why.
Minnesota Project Innovation does not exist. It's a part of the cleanup. It's not been part of our organization. So it's merely a cleanup.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, looking at the repealers And I don't know if it's just that this then appears something else. I'm concerned about the repealing the requirement for statements of economic interest. What does that mean? Is that up here?
Representative Mahoney or Mr. Kill?
Representative Kimes, Mr.
Kill.
Mr. Chair, directors are no longer appointed by the governor.
I think, Representative Kimes,
this bill is trying to separate this particular organization from the state legislatively. This organization now, any monies that come to this organization actually go in the form of grants to the company in order to pay for some of the services. So what this what Minnesota Enterprise is trying to do is allow it to hire as it needs to, and the statement of economic interest, I believe, should have no purpose to these private individuals that are helping smaller companies expand.
Mr. Chair, committee members, may I go back and make a couple of introductory comments? Minnesota Technology was established in 1991. And since that time, we have evolved from receiving state appropriations for our operations to a client fee-based structure. And it's time to update the language, and that's what's really the intent of this bill. It removes outdated functions, which have been deemed or never did exist, establishing the AURI, as an example, the Agriculture Utilization Research Institute, as a standalone organization. Additionally, we are strongly supported by our federal partners in the Department of Commerce, NIST MEP, of which we are one of 59 centers around the nation that are focused on primarily Minnesota manufacturers under 100 employees. So the bulk of the changes of this were to clean up changes that and clean up that should have taken place over the years, but have not over 17 years.
Well, I don't think that answers my question. For the reason of removing the statement of financial economic interest. For example, members of watershed districts have to file statements of economic interest. And I'm not entirely sure that they're appointed by the governor either.
Mr. Chair, if President Kimes, what example did you use of which board?
Watershed district. File statements of economic interest.
Representative Mahoney.
When this organization was set up in 1991, I think it is, all the board members having been appointed by the governor, it was a political appointment. Today, with its separation from the political process, the board members are appointing the directors and the people who would have any interest in this. So there are no political connections, so to speak, here. So there's no need for a statement of economic interest. It's just one more hindrance to find qualified people to work with these smaller companies and help them grow.
You know, Mr. Chairman, somehow I think statements of economic interest go further than political connectiveness. I think people would be would be interested in knowing who's making decisions. You know, do they have an economic interest in the decisions they're making? I don't think it has anything to do with whether they're politically appointed or not. And I'm not sure, and obviously you called. More attention is called to it when you're repealing a requirement than whether you're instating it or not. And I want to know what the problem with the requirement is and why it could be repealed for this case and what other similar things that we have that we don't have statements of economic interest for and so forth. And
Representative Khan, some of us are, where are you?
The repealers of this bill. Actually, I will also say usually I thought in the form of bills that we're supposed to get, that we've been getting recently, when we see repealers, we see the sections written out totally, and we don't have them with this bill. I don't know at what level we get to see that and we don't see it. Certainly when bills are introduced, there's another page that's usually along with the bills that we don't have
to correct
with us to look at the repealers.
Yeah.
So I'm reading from the House Research Summary, which then at least gives a, even though it gives a one-line description of the repealers, and the one that caught my notice was repealing the requirements for statements of economic interest. And I understand that a bunch of these others are because they're being put other places and the names are being changed and that kind of thing. But that one struck my, you know, is that something that I would like to not repeal unless there's some really, really good reason for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Khan, over the last 2 years since we have not received any appropriation from the state, we have rebuilt the board organization from 20-some politically appointed to 7 business-type people, 3 of which are manufacturers, others who work for large Minnesota-based employers. And we have had difficulty recruiting the quality of board members because of this complete financial disclosure, which is addressing. At the same time, they do have to declare any political contributions they might make.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I'm unique, but I'm much more concerned about their financial connectedness than I am about their political connectedness in this kind of thing. You know, if they need to be totally distinct from the state, then why don't we just repeal the whole statute and not have it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will let
Mr. Chair, we have a conflict of interest policy that's a part of this, which I believe addresses what Representative Khan is concerned about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, how can we ever see if the conflict of interest policy is being followed if we don't have the filing of the disclosure?
I believe it's a separate, just like they must declare any kind of political contribution to avoid, these are business people who, why would their financial disclosure affect their ability to be the kind of board member that we want to drive this organization?
Well, I guess once they've taken on a public role, they have another role in it. And I guess I think we'd be really interested to knowing if they're pushing a company that they have a strong financial interest in. And
Mr. Chair and Representative Khan, the kind of board that we are putting together is exactly what our federal partners, the Department of Commerce MEP, Manufacturing Extension Partnership, is asking us to create. So they want a heavy manufacturing, because that's primarily the people that we support, and they're asking us to recruit that. And in fact, we've had this language discussed with them long before we brought it forward, because this is the kind of board that they want to have, because across the nation, MEP is trying to do what we do in the States, and that is to help small manufacturers grow and thrive and compete. And the board, and getting the right kind of board members is a key part of that growth and health initiative.
And Mr. Chair, it has become pretty, it is one of the things that has come to my attention is that as we continue to ask other business owners to help smaller businesses, their concern is how much their financials have to be made public. This has been an organization that has returned $12, $15 for every dollar that is expended. and these have done a very good job, but it becomes more and more difficult as we try to get people who have expertise in this manufacturing to stay on the board. Now, I can't give you more than just to say that we tried to separate them as much as possible from the state, but still keep the namesake and their ability to work with the federal government and the federal grants. That is really the reason for that particular repealer.
Well, let me guess. There's the gentleman, and I'm sorry I don't recall his name, sitting next to you. Does he file a statement of financial interest?
I currently do.
Do you do after this bill? Mr. Chairman, is the repealer in here mean that you no longer will?
Yes, it does.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is someone who's now going to make more than the governor does. He was obviously recruited with this requirement in place, and I'm not sure I see really good reason for removing it.
Mr. Chair, again, I would just stress, Minnesota Technology, hopefully soon to be called Enterprise Minnesota, to remove the confusion constantly of membership organizations like Minnesota High Tech Association, has evolved very successfully from receiving state appropriations to being a fee-based organization. We reach out on a regular basis to over 400 Minnesota companies, small manufacturers predominantly. Our goal is to provide a 15-to-1 return for every dollar they might invest. At the national level, we're held up as an example of an organization that has evolved from appropriation-based to a fee-based, and we continue to need to recruit the caliber of people, both within the organization and at the board level, to take it to the next level. I can give you examples of companies that would not exist in the state of Minnesota today without our specialist assistance in doing that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a strong supporter of this. I'm very pleased about this. All this has been done with the requirement to state a statement of financial interest. And so I think, unless someone will strongly convince me otherwise, I'm going to repeal that. I'm going to move to strike that repealer, unless I haven't as yet to hear a good reason for keeping it. And maybe we need to fix. Maybe the statements are too onerous, and maybe we need to fix them, or maybe we need to have different ones for this. I'm open to all of that. But the idea of totally repealing it when we have it for something is, you know, I don't want to say mundane because they're very important, but Soil and Water Conservation Board, you know, that don't handle lots and lots of money, just seems not appropriate to me. So I
just, kind of, if you're going to make a motion, we'll need to have Lou Gorin on the
right
line and so on.
Yep. I move to repeal.
The other way.
Yes, I am.
People wanted to comment.
Yes, I am. On line 9.8, strike the language that has 1160.03 subdivision 11.
Nope.
I think. Yes. My person who knows something says I'm right.
Go back to that. Is that to what represents
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it's striking 1160.03 subdivision 11 reinstates the requirement for a statement of economic interest.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion on that? It's just an amendment. Representative Browning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I strongly support this. I just also think this is a great organization and to update it, but it's, you know, in the whole discussion we're talking about changing the name and updating some procedures, but this bill is a lot more than that, and this is, I think, very critical to making sure that the public interest is being served. While there might not be state money included, there's federal money here, and we're the ones that are the gatekeepers for making sure that everything is on the up and up, and I strongly support this amendment.
Representative Clark, you were on the list on the amendments or something else?
I think it's already come out. I was just going to ask what the benefit was for this organization to continue to be on the books, and I presume it's because of the federal taxpayers' dollars, right?
So in that case,
I think Representative Riley made the point that there's some accountability, and that's a good idea, probably.
Representative
Rukin, well, Mr. Chair, I'm certainly one for openness in government, but I'm just, we discussed this a little bit in the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee, and if Mr. Kill can't get anybody to be on his board, it's difficult for this organization to continue, whether they rename something else or not. So I guess, Mr. Kill, I would ask you, have people actually told you that they wouldn't be on the board because of their statement of economic interest, or are you concerned then that you won't be able to get anybody to be on your board anymore, or don't you have a problem with this, or what's your...
Chair, and Representative Rukavina, yes, we have had individuals turn us down. We have attempted to get executives from larger manufacturers, because the larger manufacturers are the key customers of the small manufacturers. And we've, over the last year and a half, have had two people reject us when they found out about this this disclosure. And we've also had small manufacturers who are family-owned family businesses that have resisted. So we do have 7 of 8 members. We're currently for one, but we do have 7 of 8. But it makes the task much more difficult to get the quality of person that we would like.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I maybe Representative Kahn can figure out a way that to make it a little less onerous on what they consider their part between now and the floor if the amendment goes on. But right now I'm just going to support Representative Mahoney on his bill, because they don't get any more state money, and I don't know what kind of federal money they get. And in the committee, Mr. Till talked about the fact that it was more of a connection and being known on a federal level than it was about federal money. So maybe, I don't know, Mr. Till, if you could inform us what kind of federal dollars we're talking about, because I didn't think there was that much federal money involved for your organization. But, members, for those of you old enough to remember when the lottery money came in, it was supposed to go 60% to the Environmental Trust Fund and 40% to the Greater Minnesota Corporation. And the first thing that got cut was the Greater Minnesota Corporation. The money went in the general fund, I think, under the Carlson administration when we were in our first budget crisis back then. Of course, we're all accustomed to rural Minnesota taking the hits before anybody else, but that's exactly what happened. And now I sit on the LCCMR, and I watch citizens pork even better than legislators, and they're still getting their money, and I don't even know if the goal of the LCMR being met anymore when I see some of the appropriations we give out. But this organization now gets nothing, and they're trying to survive to help rural Minnesota, and if this is affecting that survival, maybe we should just agree with what Representative Mahoney's trying to do, but that's up to the committee.
Hey, Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a question for Representative Kahn. Are these the same? I'd like to support your amendment, but is the same reporting requirements that legislators have exactly?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So no more stringent?
Right.
Okay. And then it also states out in there that there's conflict of interest, that they would have to, they can't participate in a vote if they had that. Typically, the economic interest is for conflict of interest. So that's still kept. Yep. So I would like to support the amendment. I mean, it seems like all of us have to do that. And right in here, it says mainly to support or if there's a conflict of interest, and it just puts it out on the table where people are at.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just listening to the answer of the witness to Representative Riccobina's question makes me all the more want to support Representative Kahn, because someone doesn't want to serve on the board because of economic interests where you're not, any dollar amounts nothing. You're talking about what real estate you own and what stocks and bonds you own and who you work for. I find that amazing. And I would ask why, what do they have to hide that they wouldn't want to serve and fill out that simple form. So I 100% support Representative Kahn. It amazes me that people can't put down where they work and what property they own. I don't think that's egregious at all.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Members, through my bioscience committee, I've had business person after business person after business person come in. The state has time and time again asked these business people to step up to the plate, share their knowledge, share their information, share their network. Time and time again, we ask them to do tremendous amounts of disclosure when we're asking them a favor. Members, I will accept this as a friendly amendment, but believe me, we are cutting out the business people that we are asking to do us a favor. And if that's what we want, that's just fine.
Okay, we have two other people, and then we'll Mr. Chair, do you just accept it as a friendly amendment?
I just accepted the
amendment, but we did have
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted, since Representative Riccobina is bringing up history, I'd like to correct the history. If you remember, there are a whole set of scandals involving the Greater Minnesota Corporation and its head, who had to file financial conflict statements of financial interest.
Okay, any further discussion on the bill? Okay, and then we can handle that appropriately. Okay. Okay, none. All those in favor of House file, I've got to get my notes out here.
You don't have to vote.
72 are getting the bill.
Yeah, I think you have to vote on the amendment.
He accepted it, but yeah, that's true. All those in favor of the Kahn amendment signified by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion is carried. And Representative Mahoney, motion then at House file 2972 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Federal Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. I'll check with Representative Riccobina. Representative Paulson is here and he's not on the committee, so we're getting close to the 10 o'clock.
I'll move also 2799, the division report, and then I move after that.
Okay, the Representative Riccobina moves the division report on House file. Okay, Representative Riccobina. Oh, here he comes back. temporarily a week late over. Yeah, we're about to vote on the division reports, and Representative Riccobina moves that the division report for House File 2779. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Riccobina moves that House File 2779 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just quickly, this is the bill for lifelong learning accounts, which are employer-matched, portable individual earnings accounts, much like 401ks, actually, that would be used to finance education and training. It's really a way to help close the funding gap for learning opportunities for working adults, and they can be targeted specifically to help individuals of lower income levels, for instance, and it's a good way of addressing the challenge of updating our education and our workforce systems. Some other states have implemented these very effectively, working with unions and business, and it's a good partnership and an opportunity, I think, to look at how we can improve the workforce for local, state, and the national economies. And so that's in a nutshell the bill. It's got some tax credit provisions that the tax committee would look at for both individuals and employers, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Someone is distributing an amendment here for
I'll file 2779.
Well, Mr. Chair, that would be an amendment. When the bill was initially drafted, it was drafted so the program would be administered by Dolly, and it would be more appropriate to have it administered by Deed, and that was a brief conversation we had in the previous division, and at first I wasn't sure if we would do the amendment in the tax committee or here, but Mr. Chair, that's all the amendment does, so we'd be happy if someone would move it from that perspective.
Representative Ruth Covina, Chair, have. As much as I hate picking between McElroy and Swig, I'm my The amendment has been moved by Representative Ruth Covina. That's Amendment H2779A1. Any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
I think that on line 5 of the amendment, what was intended before we find the first insert, I think that was intended to be delete, not insert.
Okay. That'll be incorporated into the amendment. Okay, any further discussion on the amendment?
Oh, no, not on the amendment.
Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Period. The bill is before us now, as amended. Any discussion?
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. What happens under the circumstances where someone has made this and then either dies or is seriously injured and unable to use it? Did they have? Is this ability, can this be transferred to a spouse or a child or...
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I don't know the exact answer to that. It was modeled, and when Joel Michael drafted his legislation, to be very similar to 529 plans. And so I will explore that to make sure, you know, that the answer to that question is readily available.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we've done in some of our educational veterans, and I always get slightly confused if we've done them or just talked about doing them, but I think we did this. In our veterans benefits plans and so forth, we've allowed... If the person is unable to use the educational benefits, we'd allow someone else in their family to do it. You see. And no, I'm not sure that we would want these to be logged. But
that's a very good point, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Representative, very good point. I mean, I'll absolutely explore that, but it's okay. Similar.
It does have to ultimately go to taxes, so you've made a note of the that point. Any further discussion then on the amendment? Ms. Pollock.
Mr. Chair, are we on the amendment or the bill?
On the bill.
Representative Paulson, is there a... Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, is there a fiscal note on this? We know that tax credits still have a cost to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, the revenue estimate is being done for the tax committee by the department right now.
Do you have any, Mr. Chair? Do you have any ballpark?
No, we don't. We're just literally waiting for them to identify it, and then we really have no idea.
Thank you.
That'll Representative Ruth Covina's division recommended it, but the real decision in terms of the fiscal part of it will have to be resolved in the tax committee. You've requested the note from the revenue department, or
correct, right? And no action will be able to obviously be taken until that returns.
And obviously that would have to be accounted.
Correct.
So that would be done over there. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Is the commissioner here? Not yet, so we'll revert back to Representative Ruth Covina's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, can I do it from here?
Your choice.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I'll just move
the division report on 3349.
The motion is before us on the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried.
Chair, member, just remove the expiration date on
the state grant program at the Office of Higher Education, where if there's any money left over, they can give out some living and miscellaneous expenses, you know, as they see fit, as long as they don't harm the fund itself. So it was set to expire at the end of this fiscal year, and it just would continue that way then.
And I think Representative Rukavina, if I recall correctly, we've had to extend that even
right.
biennium, and so you're just making what we've been doing permanent. Is that correct?
Right, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any discussion then on the motion that House File 3349 be recommended to pass to be referred to Ways and Means for the time?
Mr. Chairman, does this mean that we're putting it in statute rather than in session law? Are we?
I would
have. It is in statute.
Ms. Novak? Or.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the question is, and I think it's being answered, we're removing the requirement so we don't have to extend it every year from now on. This is the last time Rukavina will have to carry this bill.
That's what we understand, yeah.
Anything, Mr. Chairman, anything that gives Representative Rukavina less to do is good in my book.
I think you should give me more to do, Representative.
Okay, any further discussion on Representative Rukavina's schedule? All right. Didn't see you there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rukavina, why is the sunset in the first place? Why was it put in originally? I'm kind of a fan of sunsets. I don't mind extending them out if it makes sense, but I don't mind revisiting things. I appreciate you lightening up your schedule, but can you help me understand why the sunset was put in the first place?
Perhaps Representative Pelosi can help me out, but you know, when this was put in there, that the Office of Higher Ed could just, as they saw that there was going to be money left over, put a little more in there, and then it cancels back. I mean, it's not an automatic in the that student's portfolio, I guess would be, for lack of a better word, in the following biennium, but anyway, we had to put in statute that they could do this, and they wanted to see how it worked, from what I understand. And so they put the sunset on it to see how it would work. But it's been working good, and, you know, if there is any excess money there, they just give a little more of a grant to these students, and so that program would be automatically just in statute and not have to be renewed every time.
Representative
Blasky, your name was Representative Rukavina. That's correct. And the other issue that had come up was during the budget cuts, we had some problems with the grant accounts. And it was thought then, too, that sunsetting might be a good way to experiment before we made some permanent changes.
Mr. Chair, I think it does. I'll give this more thought. It's not a huge deal, but I we put these sunsets in for a reason, and, you know, I understand if something's working fine, there may be a good reason to get rid of it, but I'll give some more thought to it and talk with you on the before the floor, Representative Rukavina, if I've got any concerns. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cole, after I saw the governor's proposals last Friday, this is the least of the higher education worries. Maybe you can talk to the governor for me on a number of issues.
Mr. Chairman, I know that Commissioner Hansen's planning to be here, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the governor, while there are some cuts to the institutions, the state grant program is not touched in any way under the governor's supplemental. So I want to make sure we got money going to the kids. I'm less concerned about asking the institution to take a small hit, which I understand is about 1% of their total fund budget at both the U and Minsku. But I understand the governor's budget proposal holds the grant, the state grant, harmless.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Money, definitely. Being a good capitalist like you are, Representative Cole, money will definitely materialize out of thin air for those students to replace the $25 million in each institution that's being cut.
You are next, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember when this was put into place, and I remember, as Representative Pawlowski does, the 1 year we had a rather large surplus in the grant account, and I guess with our projected budget deficit in the next biennium being about $1 billion, the easiest reductions you can make is money that you weren't planning to spend anyway. And I'm wondering, does Novak used to staff higher ed, or she maybe still does? If she could give us an idea of how much was surplus in the account, and does it make sense for us to be canceling this for 09 if we have a super huge surplus or super huge deficit? If it's a few hundred thousand dollars, that maybe doesn't make a big difference for people. But if people aren't planning on this money coming in anyway, that would be a way of balancing the budget without having to make a reduction in what people are otherwise planning on spending. So I don't know if it's a question from Ms. Novak, Mr. Marks, or someone else. On, in terms of a high end, how much money was left surplus in this account in other years? Because I remember we put it in, it was a rather large surplus. I think it was in 04.
It varied greatly in terms of the amount. There was one year where it approached, if I recall, about 15 or 16 million. That may be the year you were referring to. This year, there will be a surplus generated because the Pell Grants went up, and because the state grant program piggybacks on the Pell Grants, there would be some savings. And the policy that Representative Rukavina was referring to then provided that if the Pell Grant went up, that it would be distributed under the living expenses allowance part of the formula, which basically treats all students the same regardless of type of
student. Mr. Chair.
Representative Seifert is concerned about this bill and coal, and we want to maybe look at it as a way to get some more money into the balancing the budget at the expense of the students. I'll just temporarily lay this bill over.
Okay, the bill has been laid over by Representative Rukavina.
I'm not asking the bill be laid over. I'm just, if the author wants to do that, that's fine. I just think that the legislature is pretending that the budget is all roses and that we don't have a $1 billion deficit in the next biennium. And you can blame me or Representative Cole, but we keep sending budget bills through here, spending money we don't have. And at some point, someone needs to ask the question where the money is going to come from. And I know it's the evil Republicans that always have to ask the question, where is all this money going to come from? So someone's going to have to tell us at some point. If Representative Rukavina wants to move forward with the bill, that's fine. In fact, you know, I've been a supporter of the LME and all the rest of these programs, but the reality is that at some point this $1 billion is going to have to come from somewhere, and even if it's only $10 million or $8 million or whatever, this all adds up. So if you want to move forward with it, that's fine. I just want people to be aware that this money is going to have to come from somewhere at some point.
Yeah, and well, Mr. Seifert, the bills that we're going through today had no fiscal impact on the general fund, with the exception of the two that dealt with tax credits, and those decisions would be made in terms of whatever the tax committee's targets ends up being. You were making permanent a provision. It wouldn't have changed the fiscal climate
No, Mr. Chair, it wouldn't have. But, you know, I'll just leave the bill sit there for a little while. And Representative Seifert, to your point right there, I've been asking since 2002, actually since the 2001 tax bill, Representative Seifert, where the money's going to come from. Since 2001, I've been asking your side of the aisle, where's the money coming from to pay for the school takeover? And nobody's ever answered that question. And Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, I'll read from the 2005 article after Governor Pawlenty nicked former Governor Carlson down in Rochester. And Carlson says, quote, he stands by his 2003 critique of Pawlenty's no new tax pledge. The former governor also said Pawlenty, House Republican Majority Leader in 2001, helped create the budget problems the state continues to face. Now, I could have wrote this yesterday instead of 2 years ago. Carlson said lawmakers and Pawlenty have never found a way to fully pay for the big property tax cut they enacted in 2001. They've never gotten out of the hole, Carlson said. That was a man-made hole. So, Representative Seifert, don't chide me about not asking where money comes from, because I've been asking for 6 years where the money is going to come from. And you guys said growth in the economy, and at the time, Senate Majority Leader Roger Moore told you there was a recession coming, or a slight one, and you failed to foresee that. And we've had, is it six out of the last 7 years, or five out of the last seven budget deficits? You know, the other day when Representative Cole got up and started talking about a $2 billion surplus to a billion-dollar deficit, I recall you got it up to a $3 billion surplus with your Enron accounting procedures last year, but the fact of the matter is we all know it wasn't hardly a surplus at all if you figured inflation in there, Representative Seifert. So, you know, just in ending, I might remind some of the younger members here that you guys took a $6 billion surplus when you took control of the House and turned it into a $4.5 billion surplus in less than a deficit in less than 3 years with your, you know, good financial planning. I always say that Republicans are great at managing their own pocketbooks, but terrible at managing the taxpayers. So with that, I'll just shut up. Because
okay, Representative Rucavino withdrew his motion and has requested the bill to be laid over. And as I indicated earlier, the as soon as the commissioner arrived and he's here, we would move to his presentation. Representative Morrow's bill dealing with the Department of Transportation, he requested that that one be laid over as well. So we basically completed the agenda with the exception of the presentation by the commissioner. So Commissioner Hansen, if you're ready. Members, we will be running until 11 o'clock if need be with presentation and questions. For members of the DFL caucus, Representative Sertich has indicated that he understands that this committee runs until about 11 and joins the caucus a little bit later. So I would encourage members then to stay, and this is a very important presentation. It begins to set the stage for one of the major issues that will be before us this session. So, Mr. Hansen, welcome, and if you're ready to go, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of Finance. Thank you for having myself and Jim Showalter, State Budget Committee, today. We have a slide presentation that I believe has been handed out that we will be going through to provide you with an overview of the Governor's 2008 supplemental budget. There's also some other spreadsheets that are coming around or that you may already have that provide more detail. If you look at the first slide, you will see that the governor's budget is a balanced approach, which fixes the budget without requiring new taxes. As you look, it's about a 40% spending cut and new revenues, 35% balances from other funds, and 25% of it is the solution is from the general fund. With the governor's, if you enact the governor's supplemental budget, spending for the 2008-2009 biennium will still increase 9.2%. The budget in the February forecast went up 10.3. So you go from about 10.3 to 9.2, which is still double the rate of inflation. Our spending cuts are primarily you see it's $341 million in the current biennium, $534 in the out biennium. The 35% for balances from other funds is primarily the health care access fund. We use $250 million, but leave a balance there for 2008 as well as 2008-9 as well as 10 and 11. And we also refinanced TANF for about $90+ million. And then finally, the 25% from the general fund budget reserve, it's $250 million. We still retain $403 of the $653 million budget reserve, as well as $350 million cash flow account. Those reserves and the cash flow is needed to mitigate any downturn in the economy. By the time we have our next forecast, it'll be November and then February, we will need some cushion in case the economy turns any more than it already has. The key objectives of the governor's budget solution is to balance the budget quickly in this biennium. We wanted to retain sufficient reserves to maintain the stability of state finances. As like I just mentioned, we want to have sufficient reserves available in case when after you adjourn and you come back in January, if the economy does turn down, it's good to have a few hundred million in reserves available. For those that were in the legislature in 2003, and recall we came in and we had about a $300 million bite to fix with only about 6 months left in the fiscal year. And we didn't have any reserves, so it makes it more difficult if you don't have reserves. We began to permanently reduce spending to better match revenue growth. We tackle about 40% of the problem in 2010-2011. We require spending reductions, but we use one-time funds and revenue enhancements to minimize short-term impact. The purpose for a budget reserve is to accounts that help you manage variations in revenue and expenditure growth in a $34 billion general fund budget. With variations in the economy, you're going to have fluctuations in revenue as well as fluctuations in expenditures. By using a prudent amount of the reserve, you can soften the impact of any short-term solution that you may come up with. We also maintain essential state services critical to the state taxpayer. We have exempted K-12 from any cuts. The only cut you will see is from department staff taking their share of a 4% operating reduction. And we have not touched local government aid to local communities, as well as military and veterans or other areas. We have left unaffected, as well as the general fund at the Department of Transportation.
Target center.
You will see on the next chart.
Commissioner Hanson, let me ask you a question. We have summary questions. Would you prefer to take questions as you go, or would you prefer to wait until you're done? I'll let you choose.
Oh, as you go.
Okay, Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanson, I'm looking at the key objectives of the governor, where you say in the fourth bullet point, require spending reductions but use one-time money. Is that the 25% that's in the previous slide from the general fund balance? Is that what you're referring to? Is that the one-time money?
Mr. Hanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, that is one source. The budget reserve is a one-time revenue, is a one-time source, but also, as you will see in Mr. Showalter's part of our presentation, there are other sources of one-time monies that we use. The healthcare access fund, the TANF funds are one-time as well.
Right, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Hanson, my concern is that when we had the first presentation on the $935 million, you said that was a permanent problem that we had to face. Is that correct? That's not a one-time problem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, it's a $935, actually $938 with the transportation bill in 2008-2009, and in 10 and 11, it's a $1.1 billion.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hanson, then can you explain to me, if you take one-time money to solve a portion of the problem, aren't you then just saying that we'll pick up that problem again in the next biennium because we're just going to solve it once? It's not a permanent solution to the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, we are solving, as I said, 40% of the problem. We have, in the past, after the 2002 legislative session, left a $1.5 billion hole in the following biennium, and we were able to balance that. In 2004, we left about $500 million hole after that session, but yet, again, came back in 10 and 11, or came back in the next session and solved the out biennium. We have the tools in place. What we're saying is we're going to use some one-time sources now, prudent use of budget cuts, and to try and soften the impact, and we'll see how the economy does in the next year. We have two more forecasts and a federal stimulus that's going to kick in.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hanson, I appreciate your answer. My concern is when I see statements like bring budget into balance quickly and then your statement. My concern is how much of the solution is soundbite and how much of this is substance. And it appears that what we're getting is a great deal of soundbite, and the substance we're going to put off into the next biennium, that at least this is a delay in the solution to the problem. And whoever's here in the next legislative session is still going to have this problem. We're just going to solve it once. So it's a nice soundbite, but it's really not a solution to the problem.
Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kowalski, we are fixing the problem. We're required constitutionally to have the budget balanced by the end of the 2008-2009 biennium. We have put forward a solution that fixes that problem and takes a step towards fixing the 10 and 11 solution in the out biennium.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hansen, I think we agree to disagree. It solves the problem, but it doesn't. So it's a nice soundbite, but it really isn't a solution. It's not a permanent solution, and we're going to have this problem magnified in the next legislative session. So I really do have a concern, because the way you're solving this problem, particularly when I'm looking at higher education and health and human services, those are solutions that will impact individuals, and I think we'll get an articulation of that as you proceed. But it does bother me when we apparently want the soundbite over the solution.
One more comment, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kowalski. We're in a unique situation, as you heard our state economists talk about, that the economy may very well be in a recession. I think at this point, to fix 10 and 11, you would have to do one of two things. Number one, you'd either have to raise taxes, which would be, in essence, running contrary to what recession solution that they've done in Washington. You'd be taking potential stimulus out of the economy, or you could significantly reduce spending to get to that. So either solution you pick at this point might very well harm that recovery that you want over the next year.
Well, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hansen, I'm glad you used recession, because I think at the previous meeting you and I had a discussion about recession, and I'm glad that the administration is now using it. My recollection of what Mr. Simpson had said too was to avoid using the one-time money in the reserves, that only created the problem in the out years and exacerbated the problem. So we're back again with either it's a soundbite or it's a permanent solution. I think we have a lot of soundbites here, but I'm not too sure we have solutions, and that's just a disagreement I guess we're going to have as we move forward.
He didn't want us to use all of the
chances,
Representative.
I'm sorry, your comments couldn't be heard by the whole committee.
Oh, I was just going to say, Dr. Stinson said don't use all of the budget reserve. Prudent use of it is okay.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stinson, I know, is a very conservative and forthright presenter of the facts, and I interpreted his statement differently than yours, but then I'm a moderate, so that might be the reason why.
Thank you. Hansen, I just have a brief follow-up to Representative Pawlowski's question. And you said that in the out biennium you were solving what percentage of the problem?
Mr. Chairman, about 40%.
About 40%.
It's a $1.1 billion problem in 10 and 11, and it's a $474 million.
And the point I wanted to make, Commissioner, is that when you referenced the 1.1 and the 40% of the problem being resolved, just for the information of the committee, that does not include inflation, which would also be about $1 billion. So it's a much bigger problem than what 40%, the 40% figure would seem to indicate. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hansen, I'm just perplexed as to why this whole handout is only talking about 08 to 09. You know, when I first came here to the legislature, we had a lot of attention when we were in similar straits to this, to looking at the next biennium. And I thought I remember you actually saying that would be a problem the last time you were here. And now you're into this handout that's only talking about short-term thinking. When we had the budget cuts in 2003, we cut education, and those cuts are still not paid back. $105 million of the $185 million that the governor cut back in 2003 remains cut. We haven't been able to finish up with those payments. And then it says here we're maintaining essential state services critical to state taxpayers. I have always thought that education of our students is about one of the most critical things that's called for in our Constitution and that everybody talks about. But when you have cuts remaining, and then this year we have a 1% increase for schools when inflation is 3%, I wonder how you dare to say that we're maintaining essential state services, knowing that this isn't, as the governor says, standing pat on education. This is letting cuts remain, and there will be a lot more cuts made at the local level with a 1% increase, a 3% inflation. And then the last thing I want to say, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Pawlowski referenced the state economist, and you did too, Commissioner Hansen. We all heard him, all the legislators, on the first week of session where he said, looking at the recession that we're in, and he actually named it way back then before anybody else, we need to be using some courage, and this is not a time for small thinking, but I'm thinking that what you came up with here is small thinking. It's just pacing over the problem, hoping that we have some kind of a windfall next year, when I don't know if we have any big indications of that. And I just wonder where's the next biennium parts of your handout?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Jim Showalter for the record, State Budget Director. We've sort of left our presentation, just so you understand, on the last couple of slides in the presentation were to address those issues. There's a slide specifically addressing what are the one-time sources of money that are used to address the 2008-2009 budget gap, and in the following slide talks about the implications for 2010 and 11 from using that one-time funding. The long-term outlook is definitely an issue. It's certainly something that we have tried to discuss and tried to manage within the context of this biennial budget, within the supplemental budget. And that's the key point. We haven't quite dwelled on it yet, and that is that this is a supplemental budget and a deficit that's within the budget that's already been enacted. And it's a very different kind of situation than looking at, say, when we tried to set the 2004 and 5 biennial budget, or even the past year when we tried to create the 2008 and 9 budget. The challenge that we're trying to address is balancing keeping the budget in place and not changing it significantly, or changing it as little as possible, at the same time making some progress towards the next biennium. Depending on how you define the priority, you could say that the real challenge is 10 and 11 and address that first. In terms of the presentation and in terms of, I think, the priorities in this budget, it's trying to say there's a budget already on the table, there's a budget already enacted. How can you keep that, manage the risks throughout this biennium, and not set yourself up for too much trouble going forward into 10 and 11? That's the balancing act, trying to use some of the one-time resources, at the same time make some progress towards the next budget. It's a matter of, I think, degree that we're trying to address the issues here in the presentation, and as we go through it, we'll certainly talk about it more. But it's also just a balancing act of how much do you want to reopen the entire biennial budget, when typically this is a opportunity to make adjustments to the budget that's already been enacted.
Well, Mr. Chair, I feel guilty even complaining about what's here, because I know that K-12 isn't getting further cuts compared to all the other budgets. But I just want to say that this is not holding K-12 education harmless, because the cuts that have been made have not been replaced, and with a 1% increase, many more cuts will be made at the local level. And also, I don't agree with taking all the cuts that we do have out of the other budgets. I'm glad that we don't have to make even more cuts, but some of the other ones that are here are very unsatisfactory. So I would advocate for a global solution that would include not cutting our schools like we have with this budget, and then doing better by some of the other things as well. This is not a balanced solution for education or any other budget.
We have several people that have indicated they have a question. Representative Murphy is next. And actually, I've got on the list Representative Murphy, Representative Heidegger, and Representative Seifert. And then I think after those three, we'll revert back to your presentation. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, on the second slide, you said that you were going to use TANF funds, federal funds, for TANF for solving the problem. How can that be done? Is that because of the timing of when the money comes in, or are we cutting families off of TANF?
Commissioner
Hanson. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, this budget maintains current eligibility and benefit set. So nobody who is currently on a state health or welfare program will be cut off their program or have their benefit set reduced. Can you explain how the
Sure, well, Mr. Chair, Representative. The reference to TANF will also be coming up later, but in short, TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is the federal funds that are available for our MFIS, child care, other types of programs. And right now, we're projecting a surplus in those funds so that we have federal funds that are being unused, unobligated. And we, through this budget, are looking at refinancing strategies so that the state obligations continue to meet our maintenance of effort requirements, continue to be used for the purposes necessary, but also bringing in those federal funds and making those available. The net result is some savings for the state. It's not moving federal funds into the general fund. It's basically utilizing those for the purposes which we are given from the federal government.
Mr. Chair Walter, then we don't have a waiting list at all for TANF?
Mr. Chair, Representative, TANF is more of a funding source. It's not a specific program. It's not a specific eligibility. It's a federal funding source for low-income families. That would include the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I'm not sure which other programs. There's a number of different uses of those funds based upon federal eligibility and based upon state appropriations. Certainly, MFIS is an entitlement program. Anybody who comes and is eligible by state law would receive funding. There's not a cut that's associated with it. If you recall back in our February forecast discussion, we talked very, very briefly about some other funds that were had balances. TANF was one of those places.
Representative Murphy, said. I'd like a clarification on Representative Murphy's question. And one of you said that no one would be cut off. As a follow-up to Representative Murphy's question, then, if there is someone who is in need that's on a waiting list or may come forward as a result of the slowing economy, you're telling us that they would be funded. I'm just trying to understand your comment when you said no one would be cut off. That left me with the question, well, what if there was somebody new that needed to have services?
Mr. Chairman, if you're currently eligible, yes. There were there's one provision where, and I think it kicks in July 1st of 2009, so it's in the next year of the biennium, that would take Minnesota Care eligibility from 200 to 215. That has not happened yet. That subset of people is not eligible at this point, and we wouldn't be going through with that.
Okay, so there would be some then that would, under current law, if I understand what you just said now, Commissioner Hanson.
Current law, but not currently eligible.
So that change would block some from, that if there were no change, that would be eligible from going on then.
That they will be eligible in this coming.
Oh, they will be. They won't.
Yeah, they're not eligible now. They will be.
And that won't change. They will remain eligible.
No. Mr. Chair.
You're leaving me a little confused. Maybe I'm the only one. Representative Walker, you want to help us
out? Yes, Mr. Chair. As Commissioner Hanson said it, everyone that comes into the need and qualifies are entitled no matter if we have the money available or not. So if we deplete the revenue surplus, and as we found out from our forecast, the guesstimates that they're making is that we will have more individuals who are currently not on MFIP who probably will qualify, that they're expecting the increase in the next year to go up, and that's the changes in the February forecast, our counties will pay that money, and we'll be back in 2009 as a legislature replacing that state dollars. And in addition to that, any dollars not taken from the TANF is a federal match that we mess up also. So just keeping that in mind. The way that the economy is, unfortunately, with the amount of individuals who are running out of their unemployment, having difficulties finding jobs, more individuals across the state will be TANF eligible in the upcoming year by just the guesstimates by our economists. But no matter what, the individuals that are qualified to these programs are entitled for those services. We'll just pay it and have to be, the counties will be reimbursed, no matter what.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make sure that that was clear then.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree. The February forecast takes into account estimates of the slowdown of the economy and some of the impact on eligible populations. So those are the estimates. That's the backbone for the budget that's before you. So we are assuming that there's going to be some increased needs in these areas. We're assuming that some of the spending is going to occur. And then the question is how much of the funds that are still not used, even with those increased needs, might be used for the budget solution. On the more detailed document that we're looking at on page 12 of 43, you'll see a brief discussion and the figures associated with refinancing the TANF and how that goes. As the commissioner said, it's not a change to eligibility or current eligibility standards. It's a matter of looking at the funding availability.
Mr. Chair.
We've got...
to this point.
On that point, okay, Representative Slawick, you were on that list.
Yeah. Well, thank you. To this point, I mean, this is something that this legislature has done many times before, where we've refinanced TANF. I wondered if you could comment on how much we've refinanced TANF funds in the past. When we were in the minority as Democrats, we saw the majority do this time and time again, where they took this money, in essence, take it and replace it with general fund money, and then that this frees it up to pay for the deficit. So it's unfortunately not an unusual practice that we have done, but it does, in essence, cause us not to serve people that need help. And specifically in the child care area, this has happened several times in the past years. Mr. Schulter, can you give us any examples of the amount that we've done this over the last couple of years?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have those figures. I'd be happy to follow up with you, but you're absolutely right. This has been done in the past, and it's a matter of budget practices, really, as to where you want those funds to be. We can certainly follow up with that information.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schulter, I know it's many, many millions, and it's been done many, many times, so if you could get that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawick, it's about $300 million.
$300 million.
Representative Heidegger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a clarification. I understand where Representative Perlowski is going, and I agree with him. But yet, at the same time, I'm looking at, and I just for the first time looked at the supplemental budget. Department of Health and Human Services has been growing. But yet, I wanted to get to the point that Representative Riley made in regards to the cuts in education. Something to remember, we say 1%, it's not a true accuracy, because there was a lot of special ed monies thrown in there that weren't considered into the 1%, or not figured into the 1%. But yet, at the same time, 1% may not be fair either, because of some of the prorating going on, some of the billing, the delay of a payment to special ed. There's some school districts that are actually getting a 0% or even less. And a point further, Representative Rukavina brought up the problem before. When we did the tax reform bill, we gave certain parts of the state some economic boost by giving some significant property tax reform. I've talked to Representative Markwood, said that we're collecting about $1 billion less than we should be collecting had we not done that 01 tax reform bill. But what the governor did back in 03, he told the school districts they could go back to doing referendums. But in the meantime, for some of the school districts, he took half of their wealth away. So when they try to do referendums to access money, as you all know, Representative Rukavina, it's not there. So there's a lot of things, and I think Representative Perlowski is trying to get the big picture. I agree with you. What are we doing to actually fix the problems, and we need to go further than what we're doing here.
Okay, Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, my comments are from a long time ago, and that's Representative Greiling continuing this delusional argument that she had nothing to do with the K-12 bill that was so awful last year. To chair the committee of 85 members and to blame other people in this partisan bickering, I think, is ridiculous. Did you not offer the bill, or did you not? I didn't vote for it. I thought it was a terrible bill. I agree with you. But the reality is we hear on the floor and in this committee how bad the K-12 bill was last year. I agree. It was horrible. I didn't vote for it. But you were the chief author of it. So it's somebody's fault. And you can blame Senator Clark because she's the one who got her way on everything. That's fine. But the governor never vetoed a K-12 bill. So to blame the governor, you're the one who wrote the bill. You and Senator Clark. I was in the leadership meetings. The governor didn't write the K-12 bill. It came over from the Senate. So I just want to correct the record on what was said here about 15 minutes ago on the K-12 bill. I didn't vote for it. Very few people on my side of the aisle voted for it because it was a horrible bill. But to pretend you didn't write the bill and that you weren't the chief author of it, let's be honest with people. You wrote the bill. You and Senator Clark sat down in a room and wrote the bill. So the governor's initiative was not dollar-wise a whole lot different than the bill that you came out with. If the distribution method was wrong, then you wrote the bill. Be accountable. So I'm just saying, Mr. Chair, when it comes to balancing a budget on K-12, the governor has more money for K-12 in here. If you don't like how it's spent, put it to something else. But with people in the majority complaining about these things, you're in charge. So if you don't like how it's structured in the out years, restructure it. If you don't like how the bills happened last year, you were in charge. So I'm just perplexed by the commentary here about how bad everything is when you're the ones in charge of the place. It's 85 to 49, if we didn't check our math lesson, 85 Democrats and 49 Republicans. So I just want the general public and the audience and the members here to know Representative Greiling was chief author of the K-12 bill last year. So for all of you angry about 1% in the second year, it was her bill that put 1% on the K-12 formula rather than 3%. So we just want to make sure that the record is straight on what's going on. And going back to 2003, you're in charge now. So bring out the magic wand and make everything wonderful. You're in charge.
Representative Greiling, and then I'm going to request this. There's bound to be a certain amount of partisan back and forth when we're dealing with the budget, but let's keep it to a minimum, members, so that we can allow the commissioner to finish his presentation. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seifert, methinks the gentleman does protest too much. You're going on and on out of a sense of guilt. Yes, you didn't vote for the final bill, but it truly was the governor's bill. You know, if you would do the math, you would know that we have 85 members, but it takes 90 to override the veto, and we've got Republicans to screw up their courage to help us out with transportation. But I wonder, and we could try it this year. I'd be happy to try it this year to see if Republicans would want to screw up their courage to vote for kids, too. But we didn't notice it last year, and Representative Seifert, what I will agree with you on is that we had a very imperfect process. I chalk it up to having overly optimistic new leaders in the House DFL. And Representative Kelleher and Representative Seifert, I think, held out too long hoping that the governor would come out with a good number for education. Representative Sertich, yes, thank you. Representative Kelleher and Representative Sertich are two House Democratic leaders. But in the end, we ended up with no time to go back and have a real conference committee and a real bill. I don't remember being in the room a lot, in all frankness. The governor was in the room the whole time, and he was making it very clear what he would support and what he would not. I've made it very clear that I wouldn't participate in that kind of a lack of public process again. And I told our leaders that because it allowed the governor to do what he did in the dark of night with hardly anybody there except for the top leaders, which usually did not, and I think only one time, included myself. So, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to go on and on like Representative Seifert did, but I do want to close with just one comment with my good friend and my former lead, Representative Heidgerken on K-12. I wish Michelle was the lead because he's willing to be bipartisan and independent-minded, and he's always been that way on the committee. And now he's been replaced because he was that way. And he's right when he says that some schools, many schools, did not even get a 1% increase in that second year. When I say 1%, I mean, you know, overall and average. In the first year, there was 2% on the formula and another 1% that came in from other things. In the second year, counting the money on the formula, it's only 1% counting everything, including special ed, overall.
No, I did.
But when you have an average, you always know that some districts got more, and then a lot of districts got less. And that's why I think we have to do better than this governor's budget, even in the area of education, because he says we're standing pat on that, but we're not. There's cuts from 2003 still, uncut. And there is less than 1% for many, many schools when inflation is 3. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Westrom, if you can get brief so that we can give the commissioner an opportunity to finish his presentation.
Mr. Chair, I'll be as brief as the former, the prior speaker who wasn't going to be on the list, and I wasn't going to be on the list until all of a sudden Representative Seifert wasn't the last speaker at this interval. And Representative Greiling, I hope the audience realized they just heard a long confession. I'm not sure if that's what you intended or not, but it really sounds like that's what you're trying to confess, and you're trying to confess that you admit last year was a failure by the leaders, throwing a bill, cobbling it together the last hours of the session, and it certainly wasn't the governor's bill. At least it wasn't the bill that we had been presented during session, and so you can call it whatever you want, but you were the author, and for admitting you weren't in the room and you didn't write it, but you carried it, is also something that the public ought to be a little concerned about, if that's the kind of leadership they get. And so Representative Greiling and Representative Pawlowski, to your earlier comments, I'm anxious to see your long-term vision and fix, because Representative Seifert did state it pretty clearly, you're in charge. You've got more than the majority you need. So even if not all 85 of your members lockstep like they've done on some bills support you, you still will have plenty to fix it the way that ideally should be fixed, because that's seeming to be what we hear here today. And I'll be anxious. But Representative Pawlowski, the only sound bites that I think you keep accusing the governor's commissioner of trying to come up with, I think I heard more sound bites in your speech than anything. So it sounds to me like that's the sound bite spin tactic that's being started here by the DFL today. And I'm kind of amazed that's where all the comments are coming from this table. So I'll reserve the rest of my comments and listen to the commissioner, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hanson.
Continue with the presentation.
That's right.
Rebuttal. I've forgotten it already.
A little groundwork for the next election was being laid, I think, but we'll work on the budget right now.
We'll forgive Representative Greiling for that. Mr. Chairman, members, if you can look at slide 4, it shows you in a chart the governor's plan. It solves a $938 million deficit. The $935 was in the forecast. The additional $3 million comes from the transportation bill, which spent $3 million in the current biennium. You will see the spending cuts, which Mr. Showalter will walk through in a minute, at $341 million. Additional revenue, and we also have a slide on that, that's $157 million, primarily additional revenue raised from the foreign operating corporation change. The tax reduction represents a tax reduction proposal of the governor, as well as a few other federal conformity, a veterans change. New initiative represents new debt service on the bonding bill. The compensation fund, we have $20 million from general fund in this proposal for the victims compensation fund, and then $20 million in the trunk highway fund. and then there's a few K-12 proposals and a few other things. The excess balance from other funds, $342 million, represents money from the Health Care Access Fund as well as FANA, and then finally the budget reserve at $250 million. If you look at the next page, the governor's plan reduces biennial spending from 10.3 to 9.2, which is over two times the rate of the CPI inflation in this biennium. And then you can see the numbers there, $187 million from Health and Human Services. The $1 million reduction in K-12 represents an operating cut to the Department of Education. AIDS and credits represent the political contribution refund program. Higher ed reflects reductions to the two institutions. Various non-critical public safety cuts at 17, including the courts. And then all other areas at $78 million, for a total of $341 million. If you turn to slide six, I'll turn it over to Jim, who will walk through the some more specifics.
Mr. Chair, representative members, the overall budget, as the commissioner discussed, really has a number of different elements to it. I just want to remind you of the macro view. One, again, is that this is a supplemental budget request, so the budget has already been enacted and we're making modifications and adjustments to it. Of that budget, roughly 40% is in the K-12 area. Another roughly 28% of the budget is in Health and Human Services, and then an additional 9% in local aid and credits, and an additional 9% in higher education. So substantial portions of the budget are in those four areas. By taking the current and end of session figures as adjusted for the November and February forecast, by taking that K-12 area off to the side and also taking local aid and credits off to the side, roughly half of the budget is essentially exempted or is not on the table for further reduction. That means that either you're going to take much more significant reductions in other areas, or you're going to end up having to take some kinds of other actions, such as one-time reserves or one-time balances. When you look at this slide, it discusses some of the elements that are not included in the governor's recommendations. There are some 4% operating reductions that most state agencies include, but there are some exemptions in the K-12 and local government area. There's also exemptions in the Veterans Affairs, Military Affairs, and in the operating budget of the Transportation Department, most of which is in the Trump Highway Fund. And that there are some modifications to that 4% approach in the public safety and corrections area. In terms of human services, that isn't at a 4% level either. There are some changes and some made into payment rates. I'll get into in a second. But it is also trying to hold eligibility and benefits harmless to those who are already enrolled in those programs. In the healthcare area, you do see significant amounts of healthcare access fund and TANF funds that were available based upon the February forecast. And there are some repeals of initiatives that have not been initiated that include some expansions or some delays or changes in the financing of those expansions. Overall, much of the savings is due to a reduction in the growth of payment rates. The operating budgets in Health and Human Services are averaging about 4%. In terms of, again, going back to the macro look, as of the February forecast, our healthcare programs were about 17% bigger for 2008-09 than compared with the previous biennium. After you roll in the reductions that the governor is making, that figure goes down to about 15.2% biennial growth.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, I know we like to look at the macro view, and one of the things that I looked at was that this 1/8% of statewide sales tax cut will lose us $77 million from the budget, which is a pretty macro number to me. But could you just translate this into something we could understand? We went out to dinner the other night and had a modest meal, and you know, at least I didn't have to cook it, but it was about $20. What would I save on that $20?
Mr. Chair, Representative, on the $20, I would have to multiply it through on a per household. I think it's a
I'm paying that bill, and I want to know what how much less it costs me because of the 1/8.
Without a calculator handy, I'm
okay. Good.
What?
Not much.
Not much. It's a very small amount than $20.
But you can't tell me how much it is.
It's a very small amount on your $20 is cash.
What?
6 cents? Okay.
No.
2 cents.
$20.
Okay.
That's from the social studies teacher, not a mathematician, but at any rate, roughly 2 cents is what
okay, I'm just, that's actually what I calculated too, without a calculator. But,
you're a scientist.
But, Mr. Chairman, it's just like, I wouldn't expect to be awfully grateful for that. Actually, by walking a block and a half and avoiding putting money in the meter, we actually saved a couple of dollars on it. Yeah. So.
Okay, Representative, we've got several people again, and session starts at 11. So we'll just have to be very quick for those that are on the list, and then we did get documents that were handed out. If any time does remain until 11, we'll revert back to the commissioner's presentation. But Representative Earhart.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this a couple of quick questions? Is this 1/8% statewide sales tax? Is that a permanent one, or is it for 2 years or 1 year, or what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, it is an ongoing cut, or it's an ongoing reduction. Yes.
Okay.
It's a $77 million in the current biennium and ramps up to $178 million in 10 and 11.
Mr. Chairman, is the how do we get the $20 million of the Trunk Highway Fund? Is that permissible under the Constitution or compensation fund?
Commissioner Hanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, with our reading and based on past case law, I've been advised that it is.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't it be simpler to change the Constitution so that we're not having to balance this thing and just let it go ongoing and let it build up like the federal government does, rather than we fool around with this all the time? Wouldn't you advise that we change the Constitution so we don't have to balance our budget? That would be easier.
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Earhart, I don't think how the federal government manages their finances is any good example for us.
Representative Pollack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I really, when I look at your slide presentation on health and human services, I'm speaking on behalf of Tom Huntley and all of us on the finance division. You are taking 74% of the cuts, 54% of the cuts of the deficit just through HH cuts and transfers. And that's just outrageous that you're going to again balance it on the backs of those who can least afford it. $187 million in HHS cuts, $92 million in TANF transfers, $250 million in the Health Care Access Fund. Really, you're going after this time and time again on those who are the most needy. And also, when we look at your Health Care Access Fund and what you're doing to that, it's really showing that when we have a time where people need health care, they're going to need that money. It's targeted for Minnesotans of the lowest income. And here you go, and you raid the Health Care Access Fund again. My question to you would be, how can you justify taking 54% just out of Health and Human Services?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I heard a similar comment earlier, and in terms of the math, Health and Human Services is a substantial portion of the state budget, about 28, nearly 30% of those state budgets. So any reduction in that area is going to be relatively big numbers, particularly when you take K-12 off the table, because essentially there's not a lot. If you take half of the budget off the table for cuts, and 30% of the budget gets even just a pro rata reduction, you know, nothing else can equal it. In terms of, as we're talking about proportionality, if everything was reduced to 4%, this would be less than that 4%. the dollars. I'm wandering here. I'm trying to explain the ratios, but it's a large portion of the state budget. Even at a 3% reduction, it shows up as a big dollar figure, but it is not a relatively disproportionate share if you were to have gone 3%, 4% on education and higher ed. They would all start to look more proportional.
Mr. Chair, we're going to be having hearings in Health and Human Services Finance more on this, but I would disagree. I mean, it's all how, if you look at the glass half full or half empty or where you're making your cuts, but this is an area where our needy Minnesotans are getting their health care, where they're getting the services that they need, and I hope you will rethink that.
Mr. Chairman, I just Representative Swalwick, just remember that if you are currently on a program, you are not, your benefits aren't cut, and you still maintain that coverage. The 938 is a big number, and what we tried to do is balance out and prioritize these reductions and using one-time money, and I feel pretty good about the fact that nobody who's on a program is eliminated from that program, or the benefits they currently get are not reduced.
And Representative Swalwick made a good point that the various divisions are going to be having individual division hearings on their part of the budget in the next few days, and so we'll arrive at a greater understanding of some of what is being presented by the commissioner on behalf of the governor. We'll take one last question because the floor session starts at 11, and that'll be Representative Wagenius, and then we're going to adjourn. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your choice of words when you say most state agencies will get a 4% operating budget cut. That would sound to the general public like you are cutting bureaucracy or something like that. But when I look at the specific proposals, what you're doing, at least in the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, you are reducing maintenance. In other words, you're going to say we'll do it later. You're slowing down the protection of our waters, so you're going to do it later. So we're putting off until tomorrow something that needs to be done today. So we're not problem solving. We're putting off our problems. And that just doesn't sound well or reflect well on a governor who says that he is such a good manager that Americans should send him to Washington, D.C. I don't think he's saying that.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner, you don't need to answer that. Honestly? Maybe I'm just low on
Rapp,
the
committee
right now. You don't
I'm
need to answer that.
The committee, so if the commissioner chooses to answer, he may. Otherwise,
but
he can
just one point, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the slide, Representative Virginius, the operating reduction to agencies is just one solution. We also had to look at some programmatic reductions in various committees. I would say that I, of course, I'm biased, but I think the governor has managed very well in the last 5 years. So.
Commissioner, we will be adjourning, but I do have a question. Are you going to be introducing a series of bills, or just how are you going to approach the government's budget with the legislature?
Well, we have a series of bills because it was easier to get them drafted more quickly. They are all drafted and on their way here or here. I can get you the list of who's got what, but they're all drafted and done.
Representative Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoffman, I'm going to go back and look at bonding this afternoon.
So you will be, at any rate, I just wanted to know how you're going to approach it.
It's multiple bills,
and they will be introduced sometime soon, I assume, then. Is
very
your
quickly,
plan?
Because they are governors, I guess, according to the system we've all adopted here, the budget bills are governor's initiatives, so they go to the governor's office for distribution to the legislature.
Yeah.
But at this point, I'm not sure who's got.
Well, at this point, Commissioner was wondering if it was going to be one bill or a series of bills, and you're telling me it's going to be a series.
Because it was easier to get it done more quickly. And one bill would have taken probably another week.
Okay, very good. With that, we have floor session at 11, so committee is adjourned.